Okay, everyone, so I guess we can start. And tonight I'm going to talk about some of my adventures overseas. Yeah, are you ready for some adventures? I just came back from Thailand just a couple of days ago. And I was in Thailand for about 7 days. And I thought I would talk a little bit about that and tie it in a little bit with ideas of nuns and bhikkhunis and how that is kind of changing the Buddhist world in many ways. Because my purpose in Thailand was to visit some nuns over there, I was invited to give some talks to quite a large group of nuns, 60. There was actually 60 women altogether, just over half of whom were fully ordained bhikkhunis, in other words, fully ordained nuns. I was there to teach them about, mostly about the monastic kind of rules and monastic regulations and that sort of thing. But always, there's always a bit of a Dhamma in there as well while you do this. And it was very inspiring in many ways. It was very inspiring because you realize that the quality of many of the nuns that are going forth and becoming monastics now is actually very, very high quality. These are among the pioneers of women who go forth, because the Buddhist monasticism for women is still quite new in the world. And as you often expect of the pioneers, they often are the ones with the biggest motivation, the people who have kind of the real go-go to kind of go out there and practice well and do the Buddhist teaching to the highest, bring it to the highest level, so to speak. So I was very impressed by the qualities of leadership, of understanding of the Dhamma and the Vinaya, and also the commitment to the Buddhist path. It was very inspiring to see that. It's very, very wonderful to see this. But one of the things that also was very inspiring at the same time is the fact that, I was invited to go there to teach all these nuns. How come I was invited there? And of course, the reason why I was invited is because I'm part of the BSWA. Bodhinyana Monastery, I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. And we are, let's face it, we are famous around the world for ordaining nuns. This is one of our claims to fame in the world. So the reason I was there was basically because of what we have done, our history in this area. And you realize that the impact we have had as BSWA, as Bodhinyana Monastery, and of course in particular Ajahn Brahm, has been so enormous around the world. All of these, everyone, I asked some people, have you heard about Ajahn Brahm? And they looked at me as if I was completely nuts. Of course we heard about Ajahn Brahm. You must be joking. He's kind of number one on the list of the people they have heard about. There's almost nobody higher up, especially for all these nuns, because he's part of the inspiration that actually allow women to go forth, because they realize there is support for bhikkhu ordination in the world. Ajahn Brahm is one of the great examples of that. And this is wonderful to see, that we actually have this capacity not only to support Buddhism here in Australia, in Perth, at the Dhammaloka Center, but actually it spreads out to the whole world in a very powerful way. And this was very, very nice. And I felt very privileged to be able to spend 6 full days with all of these nuns and kind of teach them about some of these aspects of the Buddhist monastic code. And one of the reasons why I was invited, of course, is that it actually is quite difficult for women monastics to come across teachers who are willing and able to teach about these things. It is still quite revolutionary in parts of Asia to allow women to go forth. It can be difficult for the women to find good teachers. So when they hear that there is this guy in Australia, this fellow, disciple of Ajahn Brahm, okay, that's really good. Let's invite him over. And they invited me over, and they kind of gave me a chance to share my knowledge of these teachings. That's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. It reflects really well, I feel, on the Buddhist community we have here. And it also reflects really well on the bhikkhuni sangha around the world, on the nuns. It is growing. It's becoming stronger. There's over 200 bhikkhunis now in Thailand. Sometimes you hear about the conservative nature of Thai society. But actually, Thai society, like everywhere, is very diverse. There is diversity, that all these nuns ordaining, kind of changing society from bottom up. There is also the conservative element there. But something dramatic, very dramatic, is happening. And there is now, there is no turning back anymore of bhikkhunis. The bhikkhuni sangha in the Theravada tradition is now strongly established, yeah, in Thailand, certainly in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is like number one nation when it comes to bhikkhunis, where it all started really for the Theravada tradition, but now spreading around in Cambodia, of course in many Western countries as well. And what a wonderful thing that is, and how that really will strengthen Buddhism in the future. I think that is fairly clear. And just to, before I talk a bit more about those particular things, I think, you know, one of the kind of the issues that have been kind of been getting so much attention worldwide recently, and I think is very important, just to tie that in with the idea of bhikkhuni ordination. One of the great things about having bhikkhunis, of course, is that it allows us more to also seek the viewpoints of female sangha, the female members of society. And I think that is very important because they often have a slightly different angle. To be a woman means that your experience of the world is going to be slightly different. Not massively different, but slightly different from the experiences of being a man. Because we are conditioned in certain ways, and this conditioning is going to be slightly different depending on the gender of each one of us. So for that reason, it's often very useful, especially for women, but I think for men also, sometimes to be able to consult other women. Yeah, go to Dhammasara Monastery, talk to the bhikkhunis, get another point of view, get another way of listening to the questions and looking at the world slightly differently. And I think this is particularly important when we have big problems, like, you know, the recent problems with this, you know, the Me Too campaign around the world, the sexual harassment and all of these kind of things. Yeah, it is very important that we have that possibility of also going to women. If you are a woman, and it's obviously this is a majority woman problem, it's a problem for some men as well, but certainly it is majority of women which have this problem right now. And it's so useful to be able then to have a bhikkhuni sangha where you can go and talk about these things. Somebody else who may understand what is going on and see things a little bit more from your point of view. It's more difficult as a man, generally speaking, to be in that same situation and understand what is going on. So this is interesting. And sometimes this kind of backfire a little bit, but I always like to talk about the contemporary issues in society, things that kind of are, you know, troublesome and that affect all of us. And right now, this problem of sexual harassment, obviously, is massive, blown up around the world. It's everywhere, yeah, in all society, all levels of society, everyone is really affected by this. So I think it is very useful to look a little bit at the Buddhist point of view. Is there, first of all, a Buddhist point of view? And I think, as always, there is, even if it is just slightly adding to what is there, there always is a Buddhist take on these things. But the first lesson, I think, is just to remind ourselves that at times like this, it actually is very useful to have a bhikkhuni sangha, the sangha of nuns, an alternative where women can go and kind of be heard about issues that affect women slightly differently from how they affect men. So this is like the first part of this. The second aspect, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, very obviously, is that all of this, any kind of sexual harassment, obviously is a question of morality, yeah? It obviously, if you really are harassing somebody else and they feel that this is a problem, obviously this is a moral question. So because it is a moral question from the Buddhist point of view, it is something that we really need to deal with as a society. We can't just allow it to slide, allow it to be like that. Problems are there to be resolved, and we try to resolve them from a Buddhist point of view. So it is a moral issue. And the last point I want to make about this is that it is important that we solve such moral issues together. One of the problems in society is often how polarized it tends to become. Yeah, people are on one side of the political spectrum or another one, one group against another one. And I think the last thing we need is kind of a fight, male versus female or anything like that. Which sometimes things often tend a little bit in that direction, even though there is no real reason for that. Still, sometimes things tend a little bit in that way. And to avoid that polarization, there is this beautiful teaching to remind ourselves all the time that we are always changing. Yeah, we are always moving from one station in life to another one. We are the victim of harassment. At other times, we are the perpetrators of that harassment. Yeah, and sometimes it may feel like you are the victim, for example. But the idea, the Buddhist idea of rebirth, ensures that we all have been in both positions. We have all been perpetrators, we have all been victims at some particular point. And when we remember that larger view of things, the broadening out, we don't think of dividing the people so much into victims and perpetrators. Rather, we understand that this is a universal problem that affects all of us in some way or another. And then we can have a sense of compassion, a sense of understanding for each other, and try to resolve this together, understanding it is a social problem, it is a human problem that affects everyone. And then hopefully we can move forward and resolve some of these things that are happening in our society. So this is just a small example that comes to mind because I'm talking about bhikkhunis and talking about contemporary problems, and I think an interesting one to see also from a Buddhist perspective. But back again to the idea of bhikkhunis and what about it, what it is that kind of makes it so useful, and what is so wonderful about it. And one of the things that always stood out for me when you read the Buddha's discourses, and this may perhaps sound strange because people hear all kinds of different things, but one of the things that stands out when you read the Buddha's discourses is how much he actually praised the ideas of a female monastic sangha, the bhikkhuni sangha, how important that actually is here in the Buddhist suttas, in the Buddhist discourses. And the things that the Buddha has to say about the bhikkhuni sangha is things like Buddhism is incomplete. Yeah, it's not really fulfilled without a bhikkhuni sangha. In Buddhism, we always talk about the four assemblies. Yeah, the monks, the nuns, the laymen, and the laywomen. And without those four assemblies, something is missing. Buddhism isn't complete. Yeah, as the Buddha says, for the completion of Buddhism, you need all four of those assemblies. And he says this in many places. And this, of course, shows us the importance of the Sangha. Without the bhikkhuni Sangha, there's something missing there. It's as if we're not really capable of bringing the Buddhist message out in the world properly. Something is lacking in what we are doing here. So actually, it points to the importance of fulfilling all the four assemblies on the Buddhist path. And of course, just to say the obvious thing, while we're at it now, four assemblies, monks, nuns, but also lay women and laymen and laywomen, yeah, at the same time. Remember that. Everyone here is part of these four assemblies. Yeah. Each one of you have a stake in this. Each one of you is a blessing for the world if you practice in the right way. Remember that. It's a very beautiful thing of the Buddha. It's not just about the Sangha. It's not just about the monastic order. Anyone who is a Buddhist, anyone who practices the spiritual life in the right way, enhances the Buddhist teachings. And in one place, the Buddha actually says that if you practice in the right way, with confidence, with integrity, with a sense of commitment, practice in these things in the right way, you are an adornment of the Sangha. Yeah, you are an adornment of this Buddhist teaching, sir. Isn't that kind of wonderful? Isn't that beautiful in a way? Each one of us, when we practice in the right way, we adorn the Sangha, we adorn the Buddhist teachings, the bhikkhunis, the laymen, the laywomen, and also the monks. We all included in a sense in this way. So remember that sometimes in Buddhism, the focus, especially when you read the Buddhist suttas, the Buddhist discourses, it may look like the focus is a lot on the monastics. But actually the reality is, it's very much, each one of us has a very important part to play in this. And this is an important thing to remember, especially when it comes to the bhikkhunis. It is important because often the kind of things that you will hear in Buddhist circles is the kind of the downside of the bhikkhunis. Yeah? You hear things like the Buddha said, for example, if we ordain women as fully ordained monastics, then it may cut the lifetime of Buddhism into half. Yeah, this is kind of the standard thing that you will often hear in Buddhist circles. And that is because, of course, it is there. It is part of the scriptures in certain places. But the things that you rarely do hear is precisely that the Buddha, much more often than saying the negative things, was very, very positive about the Bhikkhuni Sangha, about the idea of nuns, so positive about it. And one of the things that I always ask myself, how is it possible on the one hand to praise the bhikkhunis, to say that when they practice in the right way, they adorn the Sangha, they adorn the Buddhist teachings, that they are one of the four fundamental pillars that uphold Buddhism. How can you say that on the one hand, and on the other hand say that the female Sangha is like a danger to Buddhism in the future? How do these things match? And to me, there is almost an irreconcilable difference between the two. They're completely at cross purposes. Yeah, one is saying something positive, the other something very negative. And the only way I can make sense of this is to think of it as those statements that are positive, those statements that are found in the suttas, the core teachings of the Buddha, they must be the original ones. And the statements that kind of put more doubt about the significance of the bhikkhunis, of the female Sangha, they are very likely to be later, because they just don't fit with the overall message. There's something wrong about them. And if you look very careful at the text that we're talking about now, I think, personally, it is quite clear that the positive message about the bhikkhunis is actually the real one. That is the real message of the Buddha, whereas the negative one, I think, actually was never meant to be there in the first place. So this is kind of a bit of the background here, a bit of the things that we can celebrate, we should celebrate, that we are part of this historical movement of bringing the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the nuns order, back into Buddhism. And what a wonderful thing that is, and what a powerful example it is for the world, and how it is going to sustain the Buddhist teaching for a long, long time into the future, because we have now a much more balanced community that can bring this forward in a much better way. So the question then is, what else can we do? Is there more that we should be doing to kind of help this thing moving into the future? And one of the things that kind of became clear to me also when I was in Thailand and spoke to all of these nuns is that there are still problems out there. Yeah, sometimes very severe problems, sometimes lesser problems that really need to be sorted out. And probably here in Australia too, we have problems that we probably should be dealing with. And one of the problems that you find is that the nuns' sangha, the bhikkhunis, are still not as well supported as the bhikkhus. So when I went to this monastery, this was actually in the west of Thailand, very close to some big national parks, a very beautiful part of Thailand, nice and hilly with nice forest on the hills and all these kind of things. Very beautiful and a very wonderful place for women to practice. But at the same time, you realize that their physical requisites, the little huts they had and the kind of hall they had and all of that, was very simple. It was very basic, because it was still lacking the financial resources to really make the most out of the existence as monastics. Yeah, and this is interesting. It's one of those things that you see almost throughout Buddhist history, all the way back to the time of the Buddha, that it's always been more difficult for women to live the spiritual life than it has for men. Somehow men seem to get better supported, and women not as well supported. Here in Perth, I got to admit that Dhammasara Monastery, pretty well supported. Yeah, if you go there and you look at the buildings they have and the land they have, actually it is very good. That is one of the things I think we have got right here in Perth. Have all of you been to Dhammasara Monastery? Anyone who hasn't been to Dhammasara Monastery? Yeah? Okay, only one person. Two, three, four. Okay, a few of you have been to Dhammasara Monastery. I would really recommend you to go and have it and check it out, because it's a really nice place, and it has a very beautiful monastic feel to it. Yeah, very secluded, very quiet. The nuns are top class. Yeah, really nice nuns. So you really enjoy going there. I'm absolutely sure. So please check it out and have a go up to the Masada Monastery and see what it's like. Yeah. So that is one of the things we have got right in Western Australia. But still, around the world, looking at the Bhikkhuni Sangha in general, there's still a lot to be done. And I think one of the reasons why we have been particularly successful in Western Australia, and this is one of the things that Ajahn Brahm told me at the time when we did the first Bhikkhuni ordination back in 2009, he said that this is only the beginning here. You can't just ordain someone, you can't just ordain women and then leave them to themselves, to their own devices. And the reason is because they're just starting out. Yeah, they have no real mentors yet. They don't have any real support. They're just beginning this whole thing. Now we have started them, we have encouraged them to build up a monastery, build up a community. Now it is our duty to support them, to build up a strong foundation so the Bhikkhuni Sangha can be at least as strong as the Bhikkhu Sangha in the future. And it's such a wonderful thing. I mean, Ajahn Brahm, he doesn't just do things half-hearted. He does things fully. If you're going to support the Bhikkhunis, we're going to do it 100%, not kind of 20% or even 50%. We're going to give it everything. And it's such a wonderful way of looking at this, because only when the Bhikkhuni Sangha is fully independent, competent, understanding their own rules and regulations, understand the suttas properly, have a good relationship with the lay community, and are able to teach and do everything else, only then, when they kind of surpass the Bhikkhu Sangha, only then will they really be properly established. And then, of course, we can let it go a little bit more. And I have always felt that this is such an important thing, and this is one of the reasons why I went to Thailand, because I appreciate Ajahn Brahm's point of view on that one. It's such an important thing to be there to really establish this properly here. So this is the first thing. Please continue to support the Bhikkhunis, because this will be an incredibly worthwhile investment. In the future, we're going to see a very powerful and strong Bhikkhuni Sangha. We have seen this in other countries around the world. It's going to happen here as well. And when they become strong and powerful and independent in their own right, they will become an incredible blessing for the Buddhist community. Able to teach, able to do all of those things that people like Ajahn Brahm is doing at present. We'll get Bhikkhunis who are shining lights of good meditation, of profound insight, who also attain the highest stages that Buddhism promises us when you practice in the right way. So please continue that support, and then we will be building up something very powerful in the future. So this is the first thing to remember. Continue that support, continue the building it up. The second thing that became also quite clear to me when I was in Thailand is that there is still a problem with the Bhikkhunis not yet being fully recognized or officially recognized around the world. Of course, in Australia, that's not a big problem, because in Australia, Buddhism is kind of on the outside of society. There is no body that recognizes it, doesn't recognize us. So for us, it doesn't really matter all that much. But in Buddhist countries, it actually matters enormously. In Buddhist countries, the Bhikkhu Sangha is well established and recognized by society. It means that the bhikkhus often have free medical care, they have free transport on public transport and these kind of things. They are well supported by the laity, because the Buddhist institutions in society all support the bhikkhus. So they have all the support network around them. But for the Bhikkhunis, often much more difficult. They don't get, because they're not recognized, they don't get that free medical service. They don't get the free transport. And often they get problems instead. One of the Bhikkhunis, the Thai Bhikkhunis, she told me that at one stage she was arrested. She was taken to jail. She was taken to jail for impersonating a monk. Because when you are a bhikkhuni, you wear robes pretty much like us, so you look like a monk. But this was a woman. A woman is supposed to wear monk's robes, So she was taken to jail. And then the police officer asked her, well, what are you doing in monk's robes? What is this impersonation business that you have to do? And then, of course, she had some papers that showed that she had been properly ordained according to proper procedures. And then they said, oh, okay, fine, okay, you can go then in that case. Yeah, but this is kind of the thing you find in the Buddhist world. Yeah, because of lack of recognition, it means that it's actually often quite difficult to be a woman in these countries. Another example I heard about recently was that bhikkhunis, sometimes they don't get passports. Yeah, they don't get passports because they're considered kind of a person that doesn't fit into normal categories. It hasn't been recognized. So either they get the passports cancelled or they're unable to get a new one because they are like, nobody knows who they are. Yeah, they're not kind of officially recognized. And that's a terrible thing. It's almost like, to me, it's almost like a human rights abuse. It means you can't travel anywhere. You're stuck in your country precisely because of lack of official recognition of the bhikkhunis. So this is an area where I think a lot of work needs to be done, and we need to help some of those bhikkhunis abroad to find that official recognition in those countries. And of course, somebody like Ajahn Brahm has a bit of that influence. Because he's so well known, because he's very well connected around the world, if he kind of, gently reminds people of the problems, gently pushes things in the right direction, maybe there is a possibility that we can resolve these kind of things. So that is the second problem. The third problem that I still see a little bit in Buddhism is a problem of equity or equality. There still, I think, is an imbalance between the male and the female Sangha. Even here in Perth, yeah, there is a little bit of imbalance there. And the reason for that is because many of the rules that we carry with us from ancient times, they have that slight imbalance actually built into them. Of course, ordaining nuns and ordaining bhikkhunis is a very important first step that makes it much more balanced already, because previously it was really, really way worse. That kind of brings things back into shape a little bit. But I think it is something as a community that we should try to find even more balance in these things, have even better equity between the genders, because the problems of inequity, of not feeling that you are equal, it always has a negative psychological effect. Yeah, I'm sure that many of you here, sometimes you feel that you have been discriminated against, yeah? I sometimes think about myself, have I ever been discriminated against? And occasionally, yes, yeah, especially as a Buddhist monk, yeah, you are a real weirdo in Australian society, and sometimes because you are a weirdo, sometimes things happen to you that are not very nice, people shouting to you, that kind of stuff. So occasionally, me as well, even though generally speaking I'm treated extremely well by people, occasionally you do get discriminated against in this way, and it doesn't feel good, yeah, it feels bad. And if that discrimination kind of is systemic, if it's always there, part of the system that we are dealing with, of course it probably leads to a slight sense of being a little bit oppressed. So I think we should always strive for that equality in our Buddhist institutions. And the way to do that without throwing out the Buddhist teachings, is the last thing we want to do is to throw out the beautiful Buddhist teachings. But one of the ways of doing it is to recognize that there is a distinction between what the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago and the traditions as they have developed over the last 2,500 years ago, over the last 2,500 years. And when we make that distinction between the original and authentic teachings of the Buddha and later accretions, later traditions, and we move closer to what the Buddha taught, actually what we're doing, we're also moving closer to equality as we do that. There's no need, I think, to throw out the teachings of the Buddha. We can go a long way, but just separating out, moving more towards the original, and letting go of some of the traditions that sometimes can be oppressive. So that is the third aspect. The fourth aspect that I think is very important also for moving forward with the bhikkhunis and the female sangha in the world as a whole is that we, instead of focusing always so much on legal issues, technical issues, intellectual issues, that we have to win people's hearts. Yeah, very often, especially in the beginning when we started out the Bhikkhuni Sangha, we had to kind of prove the intellectual argument that this is allowable according to the Theravada tradition. Yeah, we have to show that the Buddha actually allowed this somehow. But over time, that intellectual argument, it can only carry so much weight. Over time, the argument that we really have to win is the emotional argument, the argument of the hearts, to show that this is really valuable, that it really works. And very often, when you win the emotional, the heart argument, the intellectual argument often falls into place as a matter of course. And I thought, we have quite a bit of time left, so I thought one of the things that might be interesting, I want to talk a little bit about that intellectual argument, yeah, and show why it is so hard to make sometimes. And to do that, I want to talk a little bit about Buddhist history as well, it becomes part of this, and I hope you are all really keen on Buddhist history. Yeah, keen on... Actually, I find it very... I've always been interested in history. I find history very, very exciting and interesting, actually. And I think most people probably, at least to some extent, find it interesting here. So I want to look a little bit about the problems, yeah, when we try to find a historical resolution to whether it is allowable to ordain bhikkhunis or not. Now, the traditional argument that is used... against the ordination of bhikkhunis is that it is illegal because the bhikkhunis have died out, and because the bhikkhunis have died out, it cannot be restarted again. There are bhikkhunis in the Mahayana tradition, but according to traditional Theravada, these Mahayana bhikkhunis, they don't count because they are separate from us. They are like schismatic. They have formed according to schism in the Sangha, and because they are schismatic, we cannot do things like ordination ceremonies to get together with them, yeah? And because there are no bhikkhunis to restart this whole thing, well, it's impossible to restart the bhikkhuni lineage. So this is the traditional argument, and this traditional argument is something that when you read the traditional sources, yeah, remember now, not long after the time of the Buddha, in the time of Ashoka. Ashoka was the greatest Indian emperor of all time. He ruled basically over the whole of India, except for the southern tip, including what today is Afghanistan and Pakistan and all that. A really massive empire, much larger than India is today. And he was a Buddhist, yeah. It's kind of astonishing that the greatest emperor of India ever actually was a Buddhist. It's one of those astonishing facts of history, which also happened to be true. But under his reign, while he was still the emperor, that is when there was a large spreading out of different schools. And I will talk more about that in a second. And the various schools started to form. Some went to the north, some to the south. And they separated out vast distances between each other. Yeah, and of course, over time, these different schools, they started to produce their own literature. Yeah, so the northern schools have names such as the Sarvastivadins and the Dharmaguptakan, the Mahishasaka, and then you have the southern school, the Theravadas, you have the Mahasangikas. I'm just throwing off some names because it sounds pretty impressive, right? So, but these are actually, I'm not just making it up, these are real names, right? So anyway, we can ask anyone, this is the real deal here. So these schools, they have their own literature. And part of the literature of these schools is, of course, literature which actually is meant to kind of create authenticity of that particular lineage. Yeah, so literature that looks at history from their point of view and kind of authenticates their own lineage. We are authentic because we come from such and such a background, and this is how we arose, yeah? And each school tends to view the other schools as no good. Yeah, these other schools, they haven't got a clue. They lost the plot. We are the only one, the only real school left of Buddhism. Yeah, the other ones, they are schismatics. Don't trust them. Come to us. We are the real deal. But the problem is, every school says that, yeah? So when you have 10 schools, all says that, what are you going to do? Yeah, and you realize that the history that is written by the schools, by definition, has to be biased. It is biased because their project is to authenticate themselves, yeah? This is part of the deal. It's natural. We all have to do that. When I come here on this seat, I try to authenticate our tradition, yeah? This is what I tried to do, so I'm just following in the same tradition as these ancient schools. So I'm just as bad as everyone else. Actually, I should probably go and reflect a bit on that. There's something. Jeepers. Okay, please write that down, Venerable Buddha, so we remember that for later times. It's so natural. Yeah, it happens to all of us. It's almost unavoidable. We have to kind of authenticate ourselves. Otherwise, we start doubting our own practice. It's just so obvious. But what it means is that we cannot really trust what these various schools say about history. We cannot really trust it as historical fact. Yeah. So even though traditionalists will often tend to cite these things, what we often need is to try to find a historical view of these things instead. What is that historical view? And I won't go into great detail because this is a vast area of study, and it's very grey and very murky and actually very difficult to study some of these things because the amount of solid information that we have is often very scant and we just don't know very much. But what we do know, that at the time of Ashoka, I just talked about Ashoka just a minute ago, this great emperor of India, what we do know is that at that time, because he was such a great emperor, one of the things that he did was inscribe things. Yeah, he had all these pillars. You may have heard of the Ashokan pillars, yeah? 10 meters tall, yeah? Polished sandstone, beautiful, beautiful pillars. If you ever go to India, check out those pillars. They are really astonishing. These were put up 2,300 years ago, yeah? Beautiful pillar, and it has like a capital, like a crown on top of it, yeah? With beautifully carved lions and elephants, yeah? They are really magnificent, and they are really a testimony to the power of King Ashoka and the beauty of the art also that they were able to produce in those days. one of the things that you see on these Ashokan pillars is like a wheel, like the Dhamma wheel, the Dhammachakra, yeah? And that Dhammachakra is today also found in the Indian flag, yeah? And again, another thing that comes from Buddhism, basically, and comes from the time of Ashoka, this wheel figure made its way into the Indian national flag. Very fascinating, some of these historical trends that you see here. But anyway, one of the things about these pillars, and also other places, is that Ashoka, he inscribed them, yeah? Lots of inscription on these pillars. There's also large rock faces that have been inscribed as well. And on this inscription, he talks about the kind of things that he did. Yeah? He talks about how he kind of laid down that everybody should live a moral life. He kind of encouraged everyone to be kind to animals, yeah? He abolished the death penalty. 2,300 years ago, he abolished the death penalty. Yeah? Very interesting stuff. And a lot of the things that he talks about are obviously Buddhist. They fit in with Buddhist idea, like a hand in a glove. So you can actually see it there. Yeah. Also, in one of his very, very famous inscriptions, he talks about the suttas. He talks about five particular, or is it seven? I think it's five or seven particular suttas. And some of those suttas can be traced directly into the canon as we have it today, the Buddhist canon. Yeah? You can see the direct lineage, the direct descendants of those suttas 2,300 years ago into the suttas that we have today. It's quite astonishing, isn't it? It's quite... Whatever lasts for 2,300 years, but you get this book, you open it up, you get it in the library over here, yeah? You open up this book, and you see the sutta, and then you go to India, and you read the inscription, and it says the same thing. It's kind of absolutely amazing. When you think about it, actually, it is really quite astonishing. But one of the things that Ashoka talks about on these pillars, among everything else, on these inscriptions, is the fact that he sent out missionaries. He sent out missionaries across India and also to Sri Lanka. And one of the most famous of those missionaries was his own son called Mahinda and also his daughter called Sangamitta. And they went to Sri Lanka and they started Buddhism in Sri Lanka, basically, the two of them. But they were not the only missionaries. There were also missionaries going to the north of India, or you can call them Dhamma messengers, if you like. I'm not sure if missionary is a very Christian term, but call them Dhamma messengers instead, to the north of India. And they started the schools up there. Yeah, they started Buddhism in places like Kashmir, in Gandhara. Gandhara is now in Pakistan, yeah, Afghanistan, those areas. So the spreading out of Buddhism happened at that particular time. So that is actually inscribed in the Ashokan pillars and the Ashokan inscriptions. Then, what is really fascinating, if you go to one of the ancient scriptures of Buddhism, this is a scripture called the Samantapasadika. Forget that, but that's what it's called, just letting you know. Samantapasadika means like all beautiful or something like that. In the scriptures, it talks about the missionaries, yeah? It talks about the missionaries coming to Sri Lanka, the missionaries going to the north, starting these other schools. But in this scripture, it actually gives names of these missionaries. It talks about Mahinda. It talks about another one called Dhammarakkhita, yeah? And other of these, Majjhantika is another one, how these missionaries moved out. And the third piece of evidence here, historical evidence, is some reliquaries that were dug out of the earth in Sanchi. Sanchi is in the north of India. It's where you have some of the most beautiful stupas, ancient Buddhist stupas in all of India. And these reliquaries were dug out of the ground. And when they were dug out, they had little bones in them. And the inscription on the reliquaries said who those bones belonged to. Yeah? And those bones, the inscription of those names were exactly, not exactly, but a very high degree of overlap with those names that you found in the Theravada scriptures that were found in Sri Lanka. These are 2,000 kilometers apart. One was dug out of the ground, like over 2,000-year-old reliquaries. Another one was found in an ancient scriptures in Sri Lanka. And then you have the Ashokan pillars that talk about the missions that went out to convert people into Buddhism around India. And all three of them match. The names match. The areas in which the missionaries went to match. Yeah? And this is what I mean by solid historical evidence. So all different lines of inquiry overlap and show basically the same event happening here. And what it shows us is not that there was schism. Yeah? This is what the history of each lineage tells us, that there was a schism, the Sangha was divided, we can't actually work together anymore. What this shows us is that it was a missionary activity that started off from the same group of monastics. These were people who had the same teachers, who came from the same lineage, who had the Buddha as a teacher originally, and then they moved apart. They were geographically separated, but actually they come from the same source. No schism. All there was geographical separation. Yeah? This is like the historical view of this. So it is very, very different from the view that we find in some of these ancient texts from the various different schools, which actually, I believe, must by definition be more biased than the historical evidence. So looking at the historical evidence then means that there is no problem with us doing things like ordination together because we are still part of the same group. There has been no real schism there. There has been no real distinction of one group from the other one. We are still brothers and sisters, so to speak, in the Buddhist dispensation. Yeah. This is what I mean by when I talk about the rational argument and how to kind of bring these things out. And this is then where also you can see the problems arise. For me, I think the historical argument here is actually quite strong. For a traditional Buddhist, yeah, a traditional Theravadin will say that, well, you know, okay, maybe some of these historical things are factual, but we don't know everything. There may be holes in that account. We don't know everything that happened with these people. And of course, they would be right. There's always scope for, you know, inserting new things, for adding things in there. But for me, I feel that we should take the historical account, first of all, and use that. And if we can use that to unite each other, to make more harmony in the world, to actually do ordinations together that are valid because we are creating this harmony by using history in this way, I think that is a wonderful thing. The world is already so divided. We're already kind of fighting over all kinds of silly little things in this world. If we can do more to unite, what a wonderful thing that would be, even if we just do it in this way. But you can see the problem there. A traditionalist will say, no, we don't believe this because our scriptures say this and we cannot know everything that happened in history. Someone like me who is not bound by those traditions because I wasn't born in those countries. I will have a different view and I will say, let's take the historical data we have first and foremost and then leave the scriptures aside in this particular context, because these scriptures, they don't come from the Buddha and they are bound to be biased, at least to some extent. But you can see how in the end there is a kind of, you get at loggerheads here, yeah? That is very hard to move forward. And this is why I'm saying that sometimes there comes a point when the intellectual argument has to be put aside, and instead we need to focus on the arguments of the heart, the emotional arguments. And now I feel the time has come to make more of these emotional arguments. When we use the emotional arguments, very often the views tend to fall into place according to the emotions, according to how we feel about things. Yeah, and I think that is in many ways common sense, that we are, people are emotionally driven, yeah? Feelings are such a very important part of us. Often our views are just there to kind of, you know, as a consequence of our feelings of things. And this is actually very explicit in the Buddha's teachings. I'm going to now talk a little bit about dependent origination. Maybe I should have done this earlier in my talk, because but I'm going to talk a little bit about dependent origination, because this makes this point very, very clearly here. And for those of you who know your Buddhist teachings well, you will know that independent origination, this is a very beautiful and powerful teaching of the Buddha. It shows a sequence of 12 links and how each one leads to the next one. Yeah? And in the middle there, you have three links that are particularly interesting for what we're talking about now. And that is the link that feeling is the cause for craving. Craving is the cause for taking things up, yeah, or attaching to things. Feeling is this incredibly important thing in human life because it decides almost everything we do in life. We want to feel good because we want to feel good about things. We want to have positive feelings almost in everything we do. It drives our life very powerfully. So our desires are informed by our feelings. In turn, these desires, they decide what becomes important in our lives. What are the things we take up? Yeah? What kind of entertainment we choose? What kind of things we choose to enjoy in the world? What kind of religion we choose? Yeah? Why do you come here on a Friday night to the Buddha Society of WA? Is it to suffer? Or is it to be happy? If you come here to be suffer, I'm sorry, you came for the wrong reason, yeah? Please come to be happy, because that is the whole purpose of coming here to the Buddha Society. So our religions too, yeah? Or our philosophies of life, or even our politics, whatever it is, all of this comes back to things that we do this because it kind of reinforces the cravings that we have before. We take these things up as a consequence of that. Feeling is the basic thing that drives all of these other things. One of the things that we take up, as I just said now, religion, politics, these are a category we call views in Buddhism. We have views about reality, views about the world. Yeah? So the Buddha is saying that the thing that conditions our views is feeling. Our views come from how we feel about things. Yeah? Why is it very often that people are Buddhists? Because it makes you feel good one way or another. Or you have been born into a Buddhist country, because you've been born into a Buddhist country, it is natural to feel positive about the Buddhist teachings. Or if you have become a Buddhist later on in life, again, it's because somehow it makes you feel right. There's a very strong correlation between how we feel and the views that we have. And this is very different from often how we view the world. We often think of our views and our opinions about things as being solidly based on the intellect and reason, all these kind of things. And of course, there is an aspect of reason there. But the root of this is feelings. And because the root is feelings, if we want to change other people's views and opinions, arguments are only going to take you so far. What is really going to take you a long way is to change people's emotional and feeling reaction to those views. And if you have a positive feeling about things, then gradually your views will fall into place accordingly. Yeah, so this shows us what we have to do. If we would like the rest of the world to also accept the idea of bhikkhunis, of Buddhist nuns and all of these kind of things, what we have to do is change the emotional landscape. We have to help people to feel good about these things. How do we do that? And one of the basic things to do this is to quote some of the beautiful suttas where the Buddha is so positive about the bhikkhunis. I was talking about those at the beginning, where he says that this is one of the pillars of Buddhism, one of the four assemblies that make Buddhism possible for the future. Yeah, quote more of these positive things in the suttas. Make sure that people are aware of these things, because very often people are ignorant of that, but they know about the negative aspects. Yeah, so this is one thing that we should do. But I think the most powerful thing that we should be doing for the future of Buddhism, for the future of the Bhikkhuni Sangha to really make it work, is just to keep supporting it, keep building it up, keep being there to show the world that this actually works. Yeah? And as the Bhikkhuni Sangha becomes established, as it becomes confident in itself, as it is able to teach the world from a slightly different perspective than the male Sangha is, we will prove to the world how wonderful it is, how powerful it is, what a massive improvement it is in Buddhism when we have both a female and a male Sangha, both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and of course also the Buddhist lay men and lay women. And when we prove that, when we prove the usefulness of this, then gradually people's hearts will change. People will see that this is beautiful. And when people see it as beautiful, the rational aspect will fall into place. Because the rational aspect is not clear-cut. You can look at it from this side or from that side, as I showed before. The rational aspect needs the emotional and feeling input. And when it gets the feeling input in the right way, bang, it's all going to work out. So now, I think, yes, we still sometimes have to make the intellectual argument, and I sometimes enjoy that, because I enjoy reading the suttas and the Vinaya and making these arguments. They are very interesting sometimes. But I think more important now is to make the emotional argument. Keep on supporting the bhikkhunis. And as we do that, we are growing this beautiful flower. Only now is just starting to bud, starting to come out of the ground. And as we do this, it's going to become a beautiful flower in the world. And a beautiful flower that spreads light, spreads happiness, reduces the suffering of so many beings in the world. And this, to me, is the future of the Bhikkhuni Sangha. Without that, we are like an animal with three legs. We need that fourth leg to be able to walk properly. And only then do we have a Buddhism that is really fit for the future. Okay, that is all for tonight. Okay, so are there any comments, questions, complaints, or anything else? Anyone want to say anything here? Everybody? Yeah, please. Yes, please.
Excuse me, Varunaga. If lay people, they don't have enough knowledge about bhikkhuni, why the monk, they are not sharing what they have or support them?
We are sharing a lot, yeah. You mean in Thailand or you mean here?
Yes,
everywhere.
I was in Sri Lanka, the bhikkhuni have very small, tiny, very bad situation.
Hard, exactly, yeah.
And big, beautiful temple for monk.
Yeah.
And when I talked to them about why they are not supporting or helping, they said, this is the bhikkhuni's fault, but they should not live near us.
Okay.
So it's, to me, it's nothing to do very much about society. We cannot expect them because they don't have knowledge. Yeah. My question is why the monk doesn't help them.
Well, this is the problem, yeah? And this is kind of why I'm saying that we need to kind of change the feeling of bhikkhunis around the world. We need to actually show that it has a very positive contribution to make to our society, both the Buddhist society and also society in general, and that without it, I think the future of Buddhism is very much compromised without the Bhikkhuni Sangha. We need to make that argument. We have done it here in Perth, and if you look at the Gotu Dhammasara Monastery, actually here the nuns really have a very good situation for practice. I would say it is comparable, at the very least, to what we have as monks here in Perth. I would say maybe even better, yeah, in some ways, at Dhammasara Monastery. Very, very beautiful place, ideal for meditation, ideal for so many things. And that shows you, once you get that balance right, once you get the emotions and the feelings in the right place, and we do support the bhikkhunis, they will have proper circumstances, just like the monks. So what we have to do now, we have to keep on making this argument, yeah? And over time, we can see that happening already. More and more people are actually becoming converted to the message. Just understand how important this is. And as it is happening, more funds and more support is coming to the bhikkhunis as well. And certainly, as monks, I agree with you, we have a very important role to play here. But it's going to take time. We're going to have to be patient with this. But over time, I'm sure things will change. Okay, anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. Everyone is very quiet. Okay, good. Yeah. So, or is it good or is it bad? Not sure. Good, bad, who knows, as Ajahn Brahm would say. Yeah. So, okay, Stephen. Yeah.
Do you see any practical help that Dhammasara needs right now?
Exactly, yeah, that's an interesting point, isn't it? And one of the things that I was thinking of doing, I was thinking of inviting Venerable Hasapanya down to Bodhinyana Monastery and give a talk to the monks. Because I thought, if she gives a talk to the monks, then we can actually hear firsthand some of the problems they have, some of the good things, some of the bad things. I thought that might be very interesting here. I already suggested it to a number of monks, and they were actually very positive about that. So we may do that one of these days. Then we can get some direct, immediate, face-to-face feedback and see what's happening here. Yeah. Okay, anyone else? Yeah, before we go to overseas. Okay, overseas. Okay, time for getting my glasses out. Whoa, have I got my glasses? Yes, I do. Okay, good. Otherwise, I can just see a blur, which sometimes is very handy. But the first question is from what? It's from Indonesia, England, Montreal, and Belgium. Okay, is this the same person in all those places, or is this many persons? It's like trying to squeeze many, many kind of people. This is really cheeky, isn't it? It's only supposed to be three questions. Here we get four questions in one. That's six questions altogether. Okay, either they're very smart or they're very cheeky. I'm not sure which one. Anyway, this is the question. Hi Ajahn, is there an age limitation to become a monastic? There is no upper age limitation. Yeah, you can be really old. As long as you're still breathing, you can become a monastic. Yeah, but you've got to breathe, right? If you don't breathe anymore, it's too late. Lower age limitation, there is a lower age of 20 years old. In other words, you have to have a degree of maturity. You have to know what you're doing. Yeah? So a lower limitation is actually important, because monastic life, it takes a degree of discipline, yeah, and when you're too young, it's actually can be very hard to actually follow the discipline. You can't eat in the afternoon, yeah. Mommy, I'm hungry, yeah. You may think this is a joke, but this is actually, there are stories in the Buddhist suttas, stories behind each of the monastic rules, yeah. And so the monks ordained this kind of really young, they weren't that young, they were maybe 16 or 17 or something, yeah. In the middle of the night they kind of woke up, mummy, or not mummy, we are hungry, you want to eat, relax, okay, when the sun comes up then you can eat, no, we want to eat now, yeah. So this is kind of the stories that are behind some of the rules, monastic rules. You're only supposed to eat at certain times of the day. So this shows you that this was a problem even back then, presumably. So age limitation, I don't know what you mean by that, whether you are under 20 or over a certain age. But if you are under 20, you can also become a novice monk, yeah, or novice nun. And you can still stay at the monastery if you're interested in that. So we take people, basically, I'm not sure what the youngest age, I think in Australia you have to be probably good to be 18 at least, but we'll see what happens in those situations. Okay, next question. If I have a painful neurological condition and physical disability, will I be able to ordain? It depends. Yeah, it really depends on the monastery. I think normally we work on the principle of compassion, and we are basically willing to take on board anyone who is sincere about the Buddhist practice. But of course, it cannot be too much of a burden for the other monastics. If it becomes too much of a burden for the other monastics, then in some situations we may say no because of that. So it really depends. It would have to, you know, we have to kind of have an interview with you and a chat with you and see what the condition is and see whether we can find a suitable location. If we can, then you will be very welcome to ordain at our monastery anyway. Yeah. Lastly, do you have an advice for someone who seriously considers becoming a monastic? Yeah. Advice is to try out a few monasteries first of all. Don't just go to one monastery and think this is it and this is what I want to do. Check out a few different places. When you know what the alternatives are, it is much easier to make an informed decision. Yeah? So you're of course more than welcome to come here to Perth. I don't know if maybe you are from Perth. No, you're not from Montreal or wherever you are. More than welcome to come here and test it out and see if it works for you. But try a few other monasteries as well. And then when you make a decision, you will be far more committed to the place that you're going to because you know what the alternatives are. So try it out. Try monastic life for a while. If you've never stayed in a monastery before, try it out for a few weeks. Theory and reality are often very different. Yeah, your kind of your ideas about monasticism might be just a fairy tale. Reality might be kind of bang, gets you down to earth very quickly. Yeah? So remember that you are still in the human realm. Yeah, when you become a monastic, we're still dealing with human beings. You don't enter a kind of realm which is I think it is far superior to other ways of living, but it's still, you still have to deal with humanity, of course. Okay, this is from Venerable Chanda in England. Hello, Venerable Chanda. Nice to hear from you. And your question is, if this is not covered, please could you explain why you think there is so much resistance to bhikkhu ordination in some sanghas and countries? I think the resistance comes from, in part at least, from some of the things that I was saying before, that our views are conditioned by our feelings. And remember that, you know, in a traditional Buddhist country, you grow up with certain values, and those values are going to be very closely related to your feelings. It takes a lot to change those values, yeah? We should not be surprised that it is much easier in a place like Australia to ordain bhikkhunis than it is in a traditional Buddhist country. Even though the Sri Lankans have really kind of shown how blazed ahead they are, because they really have ordained heaps of bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka, but we should not be surprised, because we don't have that baggage. We don't have any Buddhist baggage in the West. The baggage we have is kind of our Western values, and we believe in equality to a large extent, yeah? So to us it seems obvious. But in a society where these values have been kept for centuries and centuries, of course there is going to be resistance. We shouldn't be the slightest surprised that this is the case, precisely because our views are based on our feelings. Our feelings come from the values that have been laid down in society. We value our society. We value its institutions. We are all like that, yeah, regardless of what society we come from. So I think this is just a natural consequence of many, many things that, you know, of how our societies operate, basically. And I think that in some Western countries, they have sometimes aligned themselves very closely with the views that they have in a traditional Buddhist country, because they have aligned themselves very closely with that. They will also follow those traditional views. So I think this is just humanity. This is how we are. We're all like this, yeah? And because we're all like that, we just have to be patient. As we are patient, as we develop the bhikkhuni sangha, as we make the emotional argument, things are going to change. After a while, people will feel good about the bhikkhunis. As they feel good about the bhikkhunis, as they become part of the tradition gradually as well, things will change, and then the views will change, and eventually we will wonder why we had this argument to begin with. Okay, last question from Jeffrey in New Zealand. How does one find comfort in meditation? I have tried as a Westerner, but my social conditioning forever gives me pins and needles. This more than anything puts me off. Why inflict pain on the body? Indeed, I fully agree with you. Why inflict pain on the body? And I would not recommend that at all. So try your very best to find a posture that is convenient or comfortable for you. Try sitting on a chair, yeah? There's nothing wrong with sitting on a chair. Find a comfortable chair for yourself, one that is reasonably straight so you don't fall asleep, yeah? And try that and see if that works for you. If that also gives trouble to you, if that doesn't work, you can also try lying down, yeah? Lying down meditation. Find a surface that is not too soft, a kind of maybe a carpet or something like that. Lie down in the posture that you normally don't sleep in, maybe lying on your back or something like that. And I know many people who get great meditation by lying down. It's a perfectly acceptable posture for meditation practice. Remember that meditation can also be done by walking. Yeah. Not all meditation is very focused, like focusing on your breath. Some meditation is more kind of a reflection on the teachings of the Buddha or reflection on various aspects, whatever it is. And that can be done very easily by walking as well. Yeah, so there's heaps of possibilities there. So just try it all out. There's no absolute, there's no kind of tyranny. You have to sit cross-legged, otherwise you aren't meditating properly. Meditation can be done in any posture. Cross-legged posture is very nice, and if people can do that, it's great. But if you can't, there is no problem at all doing meditation in any other posture. I know many monastics who sit in chairs and do meditation sitting on chairs. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So let us just finish off by paying homage to the Buddha Dhammasangha.